Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hi, I'm Ross Kemp. Over the last 18 years, I've made some 90-odd documentaries predominantly in hostile environments, from Afghanistan to Syria, from El Salvador to the Congo. And it's fair to say that during that time, I found myself in a few interesting situations. I've been shot at, tear gassed, had knives pulled on me, and spears thrown at me. But in all those years, what's impressed me the most is the resilience of the human spirit. Our ability, no matter where we're from, to overcome and make it through to the other side. So, in my new series, The Kemp Cast, I'll be talking to some incredible individuals who all have engaging stories to tell and have themselves overcome some extremely tough moments in their lives. Right now, we are living in unprecedented times, and we should be doing all we can together to get through this as safely as possible. I hope that if you subscribe to the Kemp Cast and hear how my guests overcame their toughest moments, it may help you overcome yours, whether you're going through one right now or you're faced with one in the future. Joining me today is Mark Billy Billingham, the former SAS Sergeant Major who served an incredible 27 years with the Elite Regiment. He's probably better known to most of us as one of the instructors in the Channel 4 series, SAS Who Dares Wins. I have to say that after our podcast, we went for a few beers, and I'm certainly not a Super Army soldier. First of all, I'm going to say it's an absolute honour to be in front of you, sir. I mean, I've got mates who've served in the army, good close friends, but not many that have done what you've done. Did you think about that?
No, not really, mate. It was a job and I enjoyed it. You know, I got paid for it, but, you know, it's a pleasure for me to be here and to meet you and talk about this.
That's very kind. So we're old farts, I guess, aren't we?
We are, aren't we?
We're the born in the 60s. Born in the 60s. We're already oldest in this room. Two young whippersnappers looking at us over there. I loved the book. Thanks. I really did, for lots of reasons. Some because I can just relate not to Warsaw, because I think that was pretty. Yeah, but you know, but also the relationship with the father. My father was a copper, and he'd been in the army before that. They weren't great communicators, were they? Dads in those days. No. I've got a totally different relationship with my children to the one that I had with my father.
Likewise,
you know. Yeah. But go on, tell us. What was it like growing up in Warsaw?
It was a real fun time, if I'm honest. I mean, look back at it. We came from a poor family, like most of the kids in our street. And it was all, we're never indoors, you know. I'd get up when I was at school, I was at school. But when I wasn't, I was out until 10, 11 at night. Back in the day, kids were out all hours, you know, and you were out miles away from home, just round up to no good most of the time, I was. But
Tell me about the hat.
it was I don't know why we did it, actually. It was like a bit of a craze, and what we used to do was steal hats from the old gents, the old trilbies, and that really was where
it's an extension of knock down ginger, isn't it? It's a bit more than knocking on someone's front door, actually come running up to them and stealing their hat.
Exactly. I mean, I could get away with it because I was young, you know. I was 9 years old, and most of the people stole them off were old men. And I feel bad saying this now, but
when you say get away with it because you could run fast.
I could run, yeah, except for one particular day when I got caught. And then this guy actually became a very influential man in my life. He put me on the road to sort of staying out of trouble. He taught me boxing. I think, I don't know if you've read it in the book. Yeah, I stole his hat and he chased me and he caught me. You know, I was petrified. My two mates weren't my mates anymore. They disappeared. They legged it. and he collared me. He just stood in front of me like Kenny Everett with those big hands. I couldn't get around him.
Yeah, yeah. And Robin, people know what you're talking about. Kenny used to have these big, big plastic hands, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Yeah. I used to say Dino was off, but they definitely don't know who he is, the goalkeeper. But
yeah.
So he collared me, and rather than give me a good hiding, which I was expecting, because that's generally what you'd get, he just said, "Look, these are the words he said, you little shit." He goes, "There's something about you," because I went straight into a boxing stance, and I'd never boxed in my life. I was 9 years old.
And he said, "He's a massive bloke."
Yeah,
there you are.
Huge.
Young lad. How old were you?
Nine years old.
And you faced up.
I just, went to boxing. And he went, "Right, keep the hat, come to my gym." And of course, I'm going to say yes. I didn't want to hide in. So I actually threw the hat at it and legged it. But he told me where the gym was. And it was in a pub called the Digbeth, which I knew it was downtown. So I went. Imagine now, a kid these days.
So some old man says, "Meet me in a pub."
I'm going to teach you a box.
Ain't happening, is it?
Nah. And it's February. It's 6 o'clock at night. So it's already dark. Pitch black. Yeah. There's snow on the ground. And I'm around the back of a pub knocking on the door to meet this old guy.
And maybe lots of his friends.
Yeah. Imagine that. Saying that to your dad now.
Yeah.
I went in there and there he was. There was a bunch of kids. Some of them I recognised from around my area. A little bit older than me. And he did. He took me boxing. And he took me to one side. And that's when the first time I'd ever heard, "Always a little further, go a little bit further." And I remember him, he just stood
there.
That's
become your ethos, hasn't it?
It has, yeah. And by pure chance, when I got into the regiment, it's like the prayer of the regiment as well. Always a little further. So, yeah, it stuck with me through my life. But the old guy, he took the time and he sat me down, and no one had really done that before. You know, not even my father, because he wasn't that way. And he said, "Look, boxing ain't a sport of brutality. It's a poor man's game of chess. It's about thinking. It's about anticipating. It's about reading somebody's mind and staying one step ahead of the curve." And it was brilliant. Everything he taught me, and I carried that through life. And he was.
But you were quite a scrapper, though, weren't you?
Yeah, I was fighting all the time, constantly.
But also,
fighting.
Kids that are often bigger than older than you, right?
And it was always.
Is that just inside you?
I think so, yeah. I always felt like I wanted to prove something. I don't really know what I was trying to prove. I was tougher or, you know, I wanted to be somebody, I think. Yeah, and I was always, I'd fight anybody. And again, I come off silver medalists quite a lot. You know, I get a good hiding, but I'd get up and go again.
You got stabbed, didn't you?
I did, yeah.
By two twins?
Yeah. It was, initially, we're friends of ours, you know, and we had a couple of little gangs. And I can't remember the fight started over, but we were on a railway embankment. And I was fighting with the one twin, and I was kicking him in the face as he was going down the bank. His brother came behind me, stuck the knife in my back, and then he pulled my feet. And I just slid all, I can show the scar later, right down my back, yeah. And then
How close?
I was close, yeah, nearly died.
Yeah. And you know close?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was crawling back to the house, because it was about 200 metres from my house, I think. Crawling back to the house, and there was just blood everywhere. I was just going light-headed and sort of going in and out of consciousness.
Do you know what it was? How long was the blade? Do you know?
It was a pen knife. It was a lock knife.
People say, "Oh, people are carrying knives now," but kids used to carry pen knives all the time.
It's always been there. You know, it's just, you know, I think what's going on today is worse than it probably has been for a long, long time. But it was always there. It happened to me back then, and these things were happening. You know, and another time I was in a fight in a club. And I think I was only about 16 then. And the lights went off for whatever reason. The scrap started. And I just felt all this warm around my hands. And as the light came on, the guy next to me, basically half his face, he'd been slashed across the face.
Did you know him?
Yeah.
He's a mate? Patrick,
yeah, he was a friend of mine.
So he'd been razored, yeah?
Yeah, he weren't a razor, it was a cutthroat.
Cutthroat,
yeah. Straight across, right across his face. Missed his eye.
Lucky man.
Yeah, very lucky.
Boy.
Yeah. Young kid.
Are you still in contact with those people, some of them?
No, I'm not. I mean, actually, not most of them, but I have been in contact with a couple of them. The guy I mentioned in the book, the fighter Facey, I still now and again sort of speak to him, and I'm hoping to catch up with him in the next couple of months.
In terms of what you've achieved, which is immense in terms of where you, not only just because of where you come from, it wouldn't matter where you're from, what you've achieved is quite immense in terms of you look at the different things that you've done and succeeded at.
Mm.
Do you put it totally down to that thing, just going a bit further?
Yeah, I mean, it's just that mentality.
You weren't great at school, but clearly you have to be. What people don't seem to understand, to make it to the ranks that you've made it to, both in the parachute regiment and in the regiment, you have to be intelligent. But school wasn't for you. Why was the army for you then?
I'll tell you why, because I didn't see the relevance of what I was being taught in school. I didn't understand why I needed to do maths and the stuff that I was doing. But when I got into the cadets and I was in, what they were teaching me was like first aid, and I could see the relevance to it. and then how to strip a weapon, how to read a map, all that. So that was what I enjoyed. So I gravitated to that straight away. And then again, when I was back in school, I just couldn't
was it the
absorb
way you,
what I was being told.
Was it the way, Billy, that you were being taught?
Possibly. I mean, when I look back at the schooling, although I was probably one of the worst kids you could ever want to teach, I was a frigging nightmare. I didn't think the quality of teacher we had then were particularly good. You know, they just give you a book, read the book, and then answer the questions, that sort of thing. And that's how it felt to me. And I just had no desire to be there and do that. So I didn't go after 13, basically.
But you did go to kind of like army cadets, yeah?
I did, yeah.
It was Marine cadets.
Marine cadets, yeah.
Which and there was a guy weird. There as well that was influential.
Yeah, Matt Gaunt, who was the leader of the cadets. His two sons were in the cadets and his daughter. An amazing guy. And he talked, he talked as to the kids as we were, as like adults, and treated like adults. And if you stepped out of line, you got a clip around the ear. And that's what I was used to. That's what I expected. No, you couldn't do that.
I'm not advocating hitting children, obviously, but there were different times, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And he worked for us. He was installing discipline. You know, you knew if you stepped out of line, you pay the price for it. And he was just such a great blogger. And he took time with everybody, not just with me, with all these kids, especially the rogue kids like myself. He got the pleasure out of sort of, it's like, I guess, trying to break in a wild stallion. You know what I mean? Took the time to break down those barriers of, you're not a tough guy. This is how it's going to go, my way. And that's what it was. And I really sort of gravitated to that. I like being told and disciplined, but being taught something that I thought was relevant. And that was the difference.
I mean, that's
school.
The point, isn't it? Being told something that chimes inside you and also has a point that you understand. Or you know that voice they used to do, wah, 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 wah. It just, I mean, I'm like, I was like the window. I was like going, oh, I wonder what it'd be like to be an actor one day. I wonder what it'd be like. I wonder if D'Artagnan was real. I don't know. I like swords. I like, you know. Well, yeah, Kemp. I get that. So why the Paris then?
Well, so I'd spent 6 years as a cadet, Marine cadet, and I just missed out on the Falklands I'll talk about that in a bit, but I wanted to join as a junior leader. I didn't know where I really wanted to go, and it would have made sense for me to go to the Marines.
You're really young still.
Yeah.
How old are you?
16. 17 when I actually got in, but I'm 16 now, and, you know, in the cadets, and what had happened
was... Was he pushing you towards the Marines?
No. That was the beauty of it. He said, look, the military is your career. That's where you really need to go. That's where your heart is. That's what you've got to do. And he was right. But he never sort of forced any direction of where to go. I mean, lads that were his own son. One went in the Marines, one went in the Grenadier Guards and had amazing careers. And what had happened was the Falklands had just finished and we had a party for the guys coming back. And the lads before me that had gone, some had gone to the engineers, the paras, the Marines, the Navy, they all came back. And there was one guy there that had been shot twice on Mount Longdon. And I listened to all the stories and there was something about his story and what the parachute regiment was about that I thought, that's got to be me. That is me. It's the rough, the raw, no straight lines. This is how, and I thought, that's got to be it. And it was. And it was the best decision I ever made. Not because he got shot. He wanted to get freaking shot, like, you know.
No, but particularly three para. Yeah.
And then I went through depot and went to three para. And at the time, three para were in Belize. Right. And it was an amazing time.
I know a place called the Black Orchid. Check it out on Google. Don't. I only visited it because I was doing an investigative kind of journalistic piece of work at the time. Anyway, moving swiftly on. Let's not go to Belize just yet because... not only did you pass, you became the best cadet, the best
champion
recruit.
I mean, 70 started and 7 of us originals finished. And again, it was 7-0, and 7 finished. As in,
but that is a bit of a story of your life, isn't it?
Yeah, and that is 7.
Do you know what I mean? But it is in terms of the fact that every time that you've been set a challenge, and you've had a number of people all competing to actually get to that point, you have been the one or the four or the three that have done it.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it's that mindset.
Why?
Because I wanted it. I needed it. It's what
they would have wanted it as well. Why did you just want it that bit more?
I guess so, yeah.
Or you just built that bit better? Or are you...
I think it's a combination of all that.
But what about your pain thresholds?
I mean, it's just... You just put it to, it's in the mind. What if you've got, when people say, oh, if you've got the right mindset, you can do anything. That's not true. But you can certainly do a lot better than you know, not attempting. Yeah, and somebody who hasn't. And I just remember, I saw everything as a challenge. I saw everyone as a challenge. And I took it that way. I remember, you know, standing on the square as a young kid, looking down, and I was the skinniest. I was the youngest. And these were men with hairy chests and tattoos. And I was, you know, I was a little fish now in a big pond. And I knew that. And I was looking around thinking, what the am I doing here? I've got no chance. Look at the size of these people. And then as they started to fall, it gave me strength. And thought, you know, I can do this. And I'm doing it. And I just, and it did. It gave me more confidence each time. Every time someone else went by the wayside, it just pushed me even further to go. I've got to go.
As 70 yeah. shrank to 50, yeah. to 40, to 30.
Yeah, I got up
every
like
time that did, it gave me yeah, a buzz.
I got up like everyone else thinking, what am I doing here? Aching, you know, not knowing what's coming next, wondering if I can still do it. But then you start the day, just kick into it and you just get on with it. And again, by the end of the day, another two have gone. There's less, you know, people in your room. I'm like, wow, this is great. I loved it. Mm. And that was the same as on selection. Exactly. I'd see people in front of me on the mountains and I'd go, right, he's my next target. Forget about 4Ks an hour and whatever you got to do. He's my target. And I'd get up to him and past him. Then the next one, where he's go. I'll just keep going like that. I mean,
But that takes something. Yeah. I mean, think something that I definitely haven't got. Something that the majority of us don't have. Well, and that's what the regiment. And but I've written the book P Company Harder Than Selection.
Yeah,
why?
Because I was a kid. I was 17 years old in a man's world, and it was, you know, I weighed about 8 stone.
But you still did it.
I know I did, yeah. Because I wanted it.
How many passed?
The Paris.
P Company. Yeah.
Oh, I can't remember how many passed P Company, but about half failed it. At least half. Yeah. And again, I was the skinniest. I remember being on the log, which was the hardest event I've ever done in my life.
Just explain to people, yeah. It's a very long log.
It's a telegraph pole.
And it's got grips, yeah, steel grips.
Well, no, what it was, it's rope. It's rope grips. So you got six.
So it's swinging around as well.
Yeah, you got six portions along the line and there's eight of you on there because there's one at the front, one at the back. But by the time we finished, there was only three of us left on the log. And I was on the front. And there's a guy
swinging at you.
Oh my God. The blow behind my arm was like freaking Stretch Armstrong when I finished.
Yeah.
You know, I was literally dragging it.
Lactic
my arm was
out.
Yeah. And it's only 2 miles, but I'll tell you what's the longest
it's
2 miles.
Only 2 miles. Yeah. How heavy was that log at the
120 kilos or something. It's outrageous. And the guy on the back was a bloke. You know what I mean? He was hardly, he wasn't even out of breath, I don't think.
So what was the age difference between some of the people in that peak up?
They were from 17, and then the eldest was about 26, 27, I think.
But you still passed as the top recruit.
Yeah, I did, yeah.
Why?
Because I wanted it. I wanted to be the best. I wanted to prove to myself. Initially, I wanted to pass the course. That's the first thing in my head. Then I want to beat that guy next to me. Then I want to beat the next guy. And I've always got the mentality to keep doing that.
When you were boxing?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I could tell, probably like yourself, from the moment I stepped in the ring, once I threw the first punch, I just knew I'm going to win this. And I did pretty well, actually. I didn't do too bad.
No.
My first fight, I boxed, it was my second fight, sorry. My first fight, I actually boxed, I'd say, then tell the story in there, my sparring partner.
Yeah, because you both came from the same gym. Yeah. And there wasn't someone to match. No. You matched against, so you put against each other.
Yeah, and I had to box for another club.
Your mate, sort of.
But he put me in another club and it really upset me because I thought, they obviously think Mark's going to win because he won an exhibition, it was a fight. And then the next fight, I fought the Welsh champion. He'd had 30-odd fights. I had two. You know, it shouldn't have happened, to be honest. And
it's
I remember
a bad match.
It was a bad match, but I beat him. I knew I was going to beat him. I was that nervous. I was on my toes.
So why did you not progress in that direction?
Boxing.
Yeah.
It was an option. When I got to 16, I was toying with, do I stay? Do I turn professional or hang in there a little bit longer? And I just thought, nah, I wanted the army thing more. It was more in my blood. So I thought, that's where I'm going to go.
For me, I actually basically started bottling it. Once it got to about 13, 14, it got very, very heavy. I mean, probably.
Boxing?
Yeah. I can remember, people used to smoke, didn't they?
Yeah. You couldn't even see out the ring.
Above you like a snooker light.
That's right.
The ceilings weren't that high.
Yeah.
So it was like you were like the third round, gum shield out because I could barely breathe. I've smoked 50 fags already.
You can't believe it, can you?
I've got three-minute rounds. One more three-minute round to go and I can barely see him through the smoke. I actually bottled it towards the end and my rugby was getting better. And I also, weirdly, wanted to become a tap dancing actor. What happened?
Well, how did you get into that?
I just knew. I just knew. I say I lived in a street. We used to watch the Banana Splits, which is something you're familiar with. Many people may not be, but I advise you to watch it. And we used to go out and like cut, yeah, penknives, kids did.
Yeah.
We used to cut some twigs down. They were suddenly your rapier and your sword, and you were off doing your Three Musketeers, mate, or whatever it may be. And I just got into it, and I just thought, wouldn't it be nice one day you could go out? Well, you've done more films than I've done, and you've acted in more movies than I've done, so I've got to get to that in a minute.
Okay.
But, you know, and the reality of it is very different from the dream, isn't it, often?
Yeah, it is.
And
it is. It's actually freaking hard work.
It's freaking hard work. It is hard work. Also, it can be rather boring. And also, the other thing about what you do is, and I've never done what you do, but I've been to some of the places that you've been to and seen what some of you guys go through, and that is no joke either.
Yeah.
But we'll get to that. So you're in the Paris.
Yeah.
You're very young.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like?
It was, again, it was this new world now. You know, first time away from home.
You've got that red berry. Yeah.
Oh, it's one of the proudest moments of my life, mate. I'm now in this family. I'm in this elite unit that many have tried for and can't get in.
Got an unbelievable history.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot have come and tried and don't get there. And I got there and I did well there. And
what was it like when you went home?
Oh, I felt like I was 6 feet tall, mate. You know, I just felt like I'm the man in the house again now. This is brilliant. And
what's the relationship with your dad like now?
It was brilliant. When I come back, he was really proud of me.
He came to see you pass out.
He did, yeah. But again, he showed no emotion.
They didn't.
No, he didn't.
Dad's just like, yeah, all right.
You know what? I didn't really understand what my dad was all about until after he died. I had to do the eulogy for him. And this is when I found all this stuff about, you know, he knew a lot more about me than I realized.
So we talk about, you've had a lot of tough moments. You've been through a lot of tough experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is this the toughest thing that you've had to deal with?
Yeah, it was, yeah. And I don't know why, because, you know, I've had blokes dying around me, pals, you know, I've buried a lot of them on this journey. So losing somebody, it became second nature. Not to be sort of big-headed or weird about that, but it did. It was part of the job. But when my dad died, and although we didn't seem to have that super close relationship, it was just now all of a sudden, I'm not going to be able to talk to him again. I'm not going to see him again. I'm not going to have the arguments with him again. It was just hard to take in.
Did you feel that you had left the conversations unfinished? You'd left resolution between you and him unfinished?
Yeah, I think there was a lot more I wanted to do with him. You know, when he came to the NBA.
Unresolved.
Yeah, unresolved stuff, yeah. And I just never got a chance to do it. And the thing was, it was a total surprise when he died because my mum had had cancer for 2 years. And it was like almost like a standing joke. I'd come home on leave and I'd walk in the house and go, "Are you still alive? What are you doing?" And we'd have a laugh about it, you know, and she'd sit there with a little face and Dad would always laugh about it.
She always defended you, didn't she?
Yeah. Oh, she was amazing.
Whatever you may have got
I couldn't
up
do
to.
Anything wrong. No, well, nobody could. She'd never say a bad word about anybody, but I couldn't do any wrong. But it's funny now, you know, I go to, as we're older now, we don't go to weddings anymore. It's more funerals because all the families are dying. And every time I go there, a few aunties that are left still say to me, "Oh, you're the one who put the grey in her hair." Give me a break.
Thanks for that.
Yeah.
But your dad, let's go back to the toughest moment.
Yeah.
So your dad passes, you go back home and you're trawling through stuff and what do you find?
Well, just before that. So, like I said, my mum was dying and I was expecting her. I was out away in Q8 at the time. So I'm in Q8, phone rings early hours of the morning. It's the inevitable. You think, oh, here we go. I pick up the phone to an hysterical sister. Crying her eyes out, can't get a word out of her. So I lose my temper with her a little bit. Get a fucking grip yourself. What's going on? Anyway, she calms down. She says, I says, "It's mom, isn't it? She's dead." She went, "No, it's dad." And even now, I could just feel my frigging heart beating. I'm thinking that. And I was just like, "What? What did you just say?" And she goes, "Dad's dead." And that was it. And then put the phone down. I was like, then I'm starting calling all my brothers and my sisters, the other sister, going, what's going on? And she goes, "Dad's dead." My dad had cancer. And I hadn't told anybody, not even my mum. He kept everything.
That's the kind of man he was by the sounds of it.
Yeah. Is there
a lot of you in him?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, there is. But I, like we talked about earlier, I run my family different to the way my dad did. Mm. I spend as much time with my kids. I spoil them to death. My dad was not like that. You know, you had to get out, you had to work, you had to.
He was a grafter, wasn't he?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And so was your mum.
Yeah. 12-hour shifts, the pair of them. And so, they used to flip over.
So your dad's passed.
Yeah, yeah.
You get on a plane straight away.
Yeah. I come back, get to the house. I then take charge of everything because the family's falling apart. So, you know,
but there you go. Is this because you're Billy Billingham or is this because you're Mark? Which is your family name, right?
Yeah. It's because I'm Mark, I guess. I'm now in the family. When we're in the family, I'm Mark, you know? So I say I did the falling apart. The sisters were great. They arranged all the funeral and all that sort of stuff. But I had to sort out the eulogy and, you know, getting rid of his stuff and all that stuff with my sisters and my brothers. And that's when I found the box under his bed. And it was all...
Under his bed?
Yeah. Two things I found, which I just found really weird. He's an atheist, right? Mm. And I found a Bible. He had a Bible under the bed. And then he had this box, and in the box was all the paper cuttings and all the stuff from the days in the parachute regiment in Northern Ireland to, you know, me getting decorated for in the regiment to everything. He had so much. He had the passing out parade.
Oh, we must mention the fact that you are an MBE as well, sir, amongst many other things. There are other awards you've received for gallantry, which is quite an honour, isn't it? Yeah, so you found this box?
Yeah, and it was just...
What did you do?
I remember I just sat in his bed. I almost felt like I was going to cry. I didn't, but I was just looking through going, you old fucker, why didn't you tell me this? Mm. Why didn't we sit and have these conversations? That's again, the unresolved. We could have had a beer and talked about it. I could tell you the stories of how it happened and what
did
happened.
Did he ever truly tell you that he was proud of you?
Yeah, he did. He did. And the one thing I'm glad to say, and it, you know, to say to your dad, I love you. Mm. He was like, you just wouldn't do that. He'd look at you like, what are you on about?
Yeah.
What are you talking about? And I did. I got a chance to do that. And he did. It was that shock on his face about, what did you just say? Like, oh, God, don't worry about it. But I got a chance to do it. But yeah, he was. He did. He was
But
proud
you still
of me.
Felt, particularly when you found that box with all those cuttings in it, of all the achievements that you've managed.
There was explanations to all that, which I could have given him. You know, he's only got what everybody else got was a bit in the paper or a secondhand story. And I wanted to have a beer.
You could have told him.
Yeah, I wanted to. And that was the unresolved bit and the thing that really made it so difficult for me. And I didn't have PTSD. You know, everybody talks about this PTSD thing and I never believed in it because of what I've been through and what I've done. And I think, well, why isn't it affecting me? But everybody's different. And it is there. It is true.
And mate, it has affected you, but you don't realize that it has.
Well, maybe. I felt then it did. That's what I
went to home.
Yeah, that's when I was like, you know, I was just in this world of depression for a while. I just couldn't think straight. I didn't want to do anything. And I just couldn't get it into my head that he'd gone. I think what numbed the shock of that or got me through it quick was 3 weeks later, my mum died. Or 4 weeks later, sorry. You know, so I was back to, shit, how do I deal with this now? And then writing the eulogy for my mum, like, you know. But it was while I was writing the eulogy, I really thought about what was he like? Who is he? And I realised, and I always described him, he was a ring of steel around the family. He was there to protect us and do the best he could. He didn't have to pat us on the back and all that sort of soppy stuff. He made sure you did the right thing. And
protected.
You know, yeah, but he did. He was so tight and close around the family, making sure that, you know, we did have food on the table. We did do this. Yeah. And it was just a hard time just to never to have been able to really share those stories and those moments with him. It's like when I won the boxing, when I won the Midland title. My mum was there, he wasn't. And I wanted my dad there so bad. And it was on a Saturday afternoon, so he had no excuse not to be there. He wasn't working. He was at the pub, and it really pissed me off, if I'm honest. And it was always like that. And when I got the MBE, you know, and I was just so glad he came, you know, because it was just...
It's amazing. Massive moment.
Yeah, it was awesome. It really was. For them. I remember walking in, seeing their faces, and the read out the citations of why you're getting this award. And my dad's like, looking at me and going, he did what? he what? And I could see it, and he's like, and I was chuckling.
And also,
to
you've been so busy with the regiment. It took how long for them to actually?
4 years.
4 years.
Yeah. I feel bad saying that, but yeah, 4 years. By the time I got the fourth letter, which I've still got at home, it weren't so polite. It was like
get
your
ass down the back of your palace.
Now, you've kept her waiting 4 years. And actually, when I went in front of her, she was being busy, Mr. Billing. I went, yes, ma'am. Yeah, it was a great moment. It was awesome. But just seeing their faces, like my mum and dad, and they died not too long after that. So,
at least they got to see that.
Yeah, they did. So I'm glad of that. But I would love to have been able, like I say, talk through those paper cuttings, what it meant, what was actually going on, what was real. Mm. You know, but unfortunately, it didn't happen. So.
So you're in the Paris and you get whisked away to jungle training, don't you?
Yeah.
Or you're off
out
to Belize.
The battalion was already out in Belize.
Yeah.
And I didn't even know where Belize was. I remember saying to my mum, I just heard Central America, you're going to free para, they're in Central America in Belize. I went, Central America, brilliant. Sandy beaches, chicks, beer. I remember ringing the old Gallup.
Belize City is one of the most dangerous shitholes I've ever been to in my life. Sorry, everybody from Belize. But it pretty is.
It was at the time,
little gangs wander around the streets with AKs and everything else, and machetes and pangas or whatever you want to call it. Yeah. It can be a very dangerous place.
Lawless.
Yeah.
You know, and the value of life at the time was none.
I don't think it's improved much.
Yeah. We didn't get much time, to be honest, to go into the city.
It's all right if you're going diving in the deep blue, whatever it's called.
Oh, it's beautiful, yeah.
Absolutely stunning.
I actually went back and forth for Belize probably about 8 times over my military career, teaching jungle warfare and stuff. And I saw a massive improvement there. It's absolutely beautiful out there now. They've tidied up the streets a bit. They're still, like anywhere, they've got the ghettos.
Depends where you go, right?
Yeah, of course. But I mean, like the commercial side of it, it's phenomenal for the diving and the holidays and all that. It's really, really good. Really nice. But I loved it. Loved it.
So you arrive in Belize. Mm-hmm. You've just passed out.
Yeah. The new boy.
New boy. And I think you're really humble in the book because you talk about, you sort of learn very quickly what your place is. And it was at the back of the queue. Absolutely, carrying the heaviest piece of kit, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I've got a t-shirt, right? Because this is now 1984. It's got Belize 84 on it. And because I was the crow, the new boy, they went, got an idea. Crow 84. And there's the weapon, the Carl Gustav, the 84.
Which is a big rocket launcher, right?
They give it me. They go, right, you can carry that as well. Let's fire that in the jungle.
How much did you weigh?
I was about 8.5 stone.
And how much did that weigh?
Freaking hell, about 40 pounds or something. And then the ammunition on top of that.
And then the
gun as well. Oh, it was horrendous. So,
and all the leads.
Yeah.
To go with
Yeah.
And let's be fair, Belize is a sticky,
humid,
hot,
90% humid,
malarial,
yeah,
everything kind of like, mm-hmm. Every you sit down wants to bite you, eat you, and take some blood out of you.
I got leishmaniasis out there.
Did you?
Yeah, later on. Yeah, not on this trip, on the first trip, some years later. Yeah, that was horrendous, that was.
Describe leishmaniasis to us.
It's basically caused by sandfly, and what it does, it creates a bacteria or something inside your skin and then starts eating away internally. And the only way to cure it is, I don't know what they're doing now, but you'd have these injections every day, and they worked off your weight, your age and all this sort of stuff. And it's basically a chemotherapy in a injection form. You actually inject the stuff in and then you feel it. You can feel it going around your body. You have to lie there for about 2 hours. You take the cannula out because they can't leave the cannula. It rots the cannula straight away.
So you're basically poisoning yourself to get rid of a poison. Yeah.
And then for an hour after, you're monitored, your heart rate's monitored because it starts to mess around with your rhythm. And mine actually inverted. And I got 27 days. I got 2 more days to go.
Were you treated in Belize?
No, I was treated
back
here.
Back you got flown.
In London, yeah. So I got to 28 days, I think it was, and they were like, touch and go, should we stop this? Once they stop it, you have to leave it for a long time, then start the whole thing again. But luckily,
were you in the regiment then?
Yeah, I was in the regiment. Yeah. Yeah. I think about 8 of us got it from that police trip. Yeah.
But you talk about the jungle like it's sort of a cross between Disneyland and Utopia. I mean, I know it's a beautiful place, but I've been to a few.
Yeah.
I found it quite difficult and quite noisy and very, very scary at night, I have to be honest.
It's intimidating. And it was for me the first time, you know.
I'm itchy, look.
I remember. I'm going out to Belize, and all I'd seen is Tarzan films. And that's what it's going to be like, you know. You see all these. You do see animals. You see snakes and spiders and all that stuff that wants to bite you.
All the thing bite you. You don't often see. I have seen one. I did see when I was out in South America. I did actually see a wildcat. I went out with the Ogoni people in Ecuador. That was quite an amazing trip.
Yeah.
But also, rather very, very big, very big snakes, which I don't like snakes. I'm not a fan.
No, I ain't the big fan of snakes either. The spiders don't bite me. Don't bother me.
Yeah, yeah. Snakes I don't like.
But it was claustrophobic, you know, the first time in the jungle, you get dropped off in the middle of nowhere and the only bit of opening there is where the helicopter can get in, and then you're out. And it's everything's so close, so noisy. And it is, it's intimidating. And you're soaking wet all the time, sticky and insects all over.
You have your wet bag and your dry bag, right?
Yeah.
So every wake up in the morning and you put on that stinky, sweaty, dirty, muddy.
Stinking. It stinks of piss.
Yeah. Ammonia.
Yeah, ammonia. That's what I was after. Yeah. And it's uncomfortable initially, but you then get used to it. It just becomes second nature.
Well, some people can't.
And I loved it. No, some people can't. Some people like to have 3 showers a day and like to smell good, but it didn't bother me. I loved it. I really did take to it straight away. you know, it was hard. It was really hard. I mean
that idea, the boy from Warsaw who used to get into scraps, all of a sudden being in a helicopter, rushing across the canopy, getting dropped into an LZ and then wandering off into the jungle. I haven't said that. The two jungles, Warsaw and Belize.
Urban jungle, into the real jungle. Yeah. And it was great for me. I felt like I'm contributing to something. This is important. You know, and I felt I've got a chance to be something.
You're in the Paras. Yeah. Your girlfriend, are you winning a fight?
Yeah.
Like you do.
Julie, my first wife.
Yeah. Kids by this time?
I have, yeah. No.
Girls?
I hadn't. She was still my girlfriend then. We hadn't got married. We didn't get married till 86, a couple of years later. Yeah, so.
But so you do your jungle training. Yeah. You get through that, back of the pile, carrying the heaviest piece of kit.
Yeah.
Big and Carl Gustav rocket launcher.
Everyone else had
been
to war.
Was that a wire device out of interest?
No, it's not. Right. It's not. It's rocket launcher thing. Yeah. Anyway, so yeah. Sorry, where did I get to?
We're in Belize, and you're getting a hard time, but you're actually beginning to enjoy it.
I was loving it, but the thing was as well, everybody there, or nearly everybody there, had been to war. They'd been in the Falklands,
right.
So they'd done it and proved it. So I knew I was being taught by people.
Something happened when you were there that brought home the kind of morbid reality of what it is to be a soldier, particularly in an elite regiment.
Yeah, it's quite a sad moment, if I'm honest. There was a guy we passed out. We went up to the Battalion Lions, which was just over the road, and there was a rear party there while we were waiting for our flights to go to Belize, and was there for about a week. And there was a guy, he kind of took us under his wing, and he was a big old guy called
Benny.
Been
in the Falklands?
Yeah, been in the Falklands.
So he got through
that. Great soldier. Yeah, been through all the Falklands. And basically, he was in charge of the rear party because he was getting out of the army. He was finishing. But he was doing one last trip out to Belize. He was going to come out for the last couple of months or last 3 months. So he took us under our wing and we really liked him because that's the first time anybody really spoke to us as opposed to speaking at us. Yeah. And he was a real good guy. And anyway, so we went off to Belize and I remember him saying he's coming out. I'd been in Belize about a month and a half, so I was starting to feel like I was part of the unit then. And the alarm bells went off on the camp, which means there's an emergency. Somebody's killed or generally. Mm. And it was. And so I remember I was stood near the pool overlooking the landing zone, which was a football pitch, as the helicopter came in. And as the helicopter came in, the medics run over there and pulled out this body on the thing. And I just saw it was Benny. And he was, like I say, the whole world just collapsed. I was like, what? This is real shit. You know, everything's going through my head. He's just come out to get some money because he's getting married. He's leaving the army. It was just awful. It was terrible. And it was a real...
That realisation.
Yeah. This ain't a game no more. Yeah,
I sort of experienced that for my first trip out in Afghanistan. Yeah. Someone actually died before we'd actually even left Bastion.
Yeah.
Negligent discharge. Dead. Wow. And you go, well, I just saw him 2 hours ago. No, now no more.
Yeah.
And isn't it? I mean, it's different if you're actually a true soldier, a real soldier, but just being attached to and watching the effect that has on everybody.
Yeah, it did.
Even though you're sort of saying, I am a soldier, I am in an elite regiment, I will be called upon to, if I do my job, to kill people and to watch my comrades probably die around me. When someone actually does die...
The reality is different. Yeah, oh my God. Yeah, it's just...
But it ain't like it is in the movies, that's for sure.
No. It's not me. And I don't care how big and tough you are. It brings you down. You're like, wow, that could be me. Quite possibly will be me.
Yeah.
You know, and...
Particularly considering the career path that you took. Mm. So let's go back personal now. So you've got a girlfriend.
Yeah.
You're now back at Aldershot.
Yeah. And you come back from Belize back to Aldershot.
Yeah. And Northern Ireland.
Yeah. Then...
The troubles.
No, we went to Cyprus after that. Cyprus on a UN tour.
Yeah, which you thought was going to be a holiday?
Oh, yeah. I couldn't believe it.
My dad was out in Cyprus for a bit as well. Yeah. He didn't have a holiday either.
This is 86. Well, it was supposed to be, you know, a bit of a sort of sunshine play, sunshine holiday at work, but play as well.
It still is for some people.
Yeah, it weren't for us. We literally got there, and I think the day we got there, the day after, the PLO attacked Akatiri with RPG-7s.
Right.
There was a soldier shot on the main road outside our barrack. Oh, everything hit the roof like
people seem to have forgotten about that.
Yeah,
as well,
I know.
That
I know.
Conflict.
I know. It just swept under the carpet and forgotten about. But so it was full on. It was like being in Northern Ireland, but in a odd place, which was, you know, it was hard work.
Mm.
And it was dangerous at times, but good.
But you're out doing patrols?
Yeah, I'm doing patrols, vehicle stops, just like in Northern Ireland. OPs watching for boats coming in because weapons were coming in from the sea, you know, across from Turkey or wherever they were coming from. Mm. Yeah, so it was just full on. But again, I loved it. It was great. I wouldn't mind if I get down to the beach now and again, but this is all right. I could see it from a distance.
Do you think your superiors at that point saw something in you that was different to some of the other guys?
Yes, yeah, they do. I mean,
because you passed out as best.
Yeah, champion recruit.
Yeah. You're the crow.
Yeah.
83, was it?
84.
84.
Yeah.
Then you move your way up to the front of the line. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Then you're starting running patrols, right?
Yeah,
by the time you get to Cyprus.
Yeah, that's right.
When did you get your lance?
Yeah, I was a lance corporal in Cyprus. Was I a lance corporal? Yeah, I was. I was a lance corporal for Cyprus. I was like a 2IC of a section. You know, I was in charge of 4 blokes by now.
Second in command.
Yeah, second in command, which was great. And like I say, and I was always, I want to be there next. And I want to be there next. I knew where I wanted to go. I knew what I wanted, you know. But I weren't...
Had the word SAS actually raised itself inside
Cyprus,
your consciousness.
Cyprus, you know, some of the older guys were talking about going on selection and doing it.
It does stand for Super Army Soldier, doesn't it?
It does now.
God, so you're you're conscious of a Sandberry rather than a Redberry now, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, the parachute regiment was fantastic, great soldiering, but operationally, you know, everyone knew the regiment, the SAS, were out there doing it all the time, yeah. And I thought, that's where I've got to go. I want to prove myself here, you know, and then I want to take it to the next level. And the next level was, you know, it's like, it was just something I had to do. I wanted to do. I've got to do this.
So here's a question for you. Yeah. Is it about the camaraderie, the friendship? Is it about doing it for Queen and country? Or is it for you about showing everybody that you're the best or one of the best?
No.
Or is it a mixture of all those?
It's a mixture of all of it. I'm all for Queen and Country. I love it. I really am. I'm very patriotic.
Same here.
Yeah. And I love the camaraderie. And it is a family. Like I say, losing Benny for the first time, that it was like losing, again, my dad or my brother. It was family now. He weren't just a bloke I know. He was family. He'd have my back like I'd have his back. Now he's gone. So the reality of all that. But yeah, it's that camaraderie, it's just second to none. It really
but
is.
But there's a confidence in the military. It's about the camaraderie, but also each time you went P Company, you know, you're getting rapidly promoted quicker than other people, maybe people have been there longer, and you're on a kind of like quite a rapid rise.
And I weren't.
Was that self-driven?
It was, you know, I'm a team player. I'm not one of these, want to be.
That's the whole point that you join, right?
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
Also at the same point, you want to be at point, don't you?
Yeah, I want to prove myself. Can I make those decisions? Can I be the one to get in there and do that? And I wanted to do it. That's why the regiment was in my sights by then. I thought, I've got to do this. I've got to get out there and prove myself to the next level. The next level would have been, because I didn't really know what, no one really knew what the regiment was doing. They knew they're doing something. They're always slapping naughty people somewhere. So I thought, I want to get out there and do that. So, yeah, so I was starting to think of it back in Cyprus, and some of the guys were going on selection. Then I looked at, I mean, about 8 guys from the battalion went on selection, only one got through. I thought, and these were fit guys. I was looking at them, judging myself by them, thinking, well, if they can't get through, I can't get through. But that's where, again, I think, well, I won't know unless I try, and I'm going to try. And it was a repeat sort of performance from when I joined in 83, when I joined, went on selection. Same thing, there was 280 of us, 283 of us.
283. Yeah. And how many actually make it?
7. Yeah. I know we lost 80 on day 2. 8-0 on the fan dance.
Part of it, a fan dance being the Penny Fan, right? Yeah. Which is one of the biggest mountains in the Black Mountains.
That's right. It's the biggest one, yeah.
Yeah. And what, 50% go on that one day?
Yeah.
But now part of it is about navigation.
Yeah.
But a lot of it is about your ability to take pain. Yeah. I would suggest
endurance and
the ability to go further, which you always say, and obviously a lot of them, 50% didn't have that then, right? But can I just say, I think all the way through your book is about the fact that you go further, but in order to go further, you have to endure discomfort, pain, whether it be mental or physical.
Yeah.
What is it like falling into a vat of caustic soda, which is used to strip metal?
I mean, I had to talk about this, and
This is before you were ever in the army. This is before, you know, you're a young lad, right?
I was working on a night shift illegally. And
how old?
I was nearly 16, 15, just before I joined the army.
So you should.
That's why I couldn't get in the army.
Because
of the injuries.
So just out of interest, how do you fall into that course?
So what happened was I was working the night shift and
what was the factory?
It was electroplating. It's closed now actually, RJ Glaze. And funny old thing, my dad had worked there 20 years before.
Really?
Yeah. So the way it works is you've got these vats, which is like...
How big are they?
About 6 foot, 6-7 foot. And in the each one's got a different...
type of acid or
water or alkaline or caustic soda, etc. So you put the raw metal in and strip it down, and then you put and then it becomes out the other end.
It's used in the manufacture of aluminium, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I mean, literally, it melts stuff.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it melts rust off metal.
So yeah, what's it do to flesh and bone then?
Oh, Jesus Christ! I tell you, I basically use a crane to move the stuff up and down, and I'd misjudged it. You stood on a crane platform. So this is the vat here.
Yeah.
You stood on this crane here, and you pick the work up, the jig, bring it along.
Slide it across, drop it in.
Down, in there for 10 minutes, up into the next, and so forth.
Right.
And I misjudged it on the caustic soda. It hit the side and bounced off. So I had to now climb up on top to realign it, and that's what I did. So I stood up on top, and at the time, I remember, it was about 1 o'clock in the morning or something. No one else is in the factory. The other guy who was working with me had gone to the toilet or something. So I remember there's no one else there. Carl, his name was. I thought, right, I better get this done. So I climb up on the top in these Wellington boots and dungarees things. I'm trying to get it on. As I'm doing it, I slip. And I went into both feet together into the caustic soda. And really, I should have just gone straight down. To this day, I don't know. It must have been the pain. So as it got past my Wellingtons, obviously it all went inside. And I just sort of backflipped. And as I'm sort of coming off the top of the jig towards the floor, Carl grabs me.
He's there.
Yeah, he's there.
If he hadn't been there,
I'd have hit the floor. I mean, I guess I'd have been all right. I'd probably crack my skull open. So he catches me and runs me straight down to the tap.
I'm pushing you.
Turns the tap on and pulls the wellies off. And as he's pulling the wellies off, literally my skin just dropped out with it. And it's just melting. Yeah, now I can feel the pain. It was like, you know that when you get kicked in the balls and you get that.
Yeah,
really. It was like that. It was excruciating.
Burn for me has to be, and I've met some guys who suffered some awful burns. I mean, you burn your finger, like, you know, that hurts. Yeah. That kind of burn.
Oh, so from just down below the knees, it just basically took all the skin off. Yeah, and then between the Achilles and the back of my leg there, it just went straight into a hole, both sides. So we're tipping all this water, getting all this water, and then I end up getting taken down to the hospital and dealt with there. But that's why I couldn't get in the military.
How bad were the burns?
Really bad.
I mean, you couldn't?
Really bad. I think I was in hospital for about 3 or 4 days because they had to keep diluting it with these other chemicals because it was still burning.
Still
and
active.
Then, yeah, and then still they just padded out all the holes and then just sort of rebuilt it over, I think it took nearly 12 months. Yeah.
To heal?
Yeah. Heal enough to allow me to go in the army. Yeah. And then obviously I had to start training in between that. So it was a tough time. But yeah, it was horrible. It was horrendous. And I do not know how... I'd have not flipped out of it. I'd have been gone in seconds.
Well, that's what you get rid of bodies, actually. You drop them in vats of caustic soda.
I can't talk about that.
Anyway, moving swiftly back now. Let's fast forward.
Yeah.
As you can. I mean, quite an amazing trajectory in terms of your career at 3Para, but now you've got your sights set on becoming a member of the most elite regiment in the world.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Still known to be that.
They are that. They're exactly that.
If you look at the Americans, and I've spent time out in places where I've bumped into SF from all sorts of different places. I mean, the numbers that they have, Delta, SEALs, etc., are massive in comparison. Yeah. I mean, I don't forget going out with, I was out with the American Marines out in Musa Carla. I've been out with five Scots and one Royal Irish the year before. The one thing that you talk about, and I'm digressing slightly, but the ability of a British soldier, particularly from the elite regiments, is the ability to cope with very little and do very much.
Yeah.
Whereas I think the US Marine Corps has more planes, more ships, and more men than the entire Navy, Air Force, and Army of the United Kingdom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Do you think so? That ability to adapt and survive, or adapt and overcome, is that
the ethos of the British Open because we are small and because we haven't got very much money.
It's exactly that, and it makes us what we are, you know, because you have to, you've got to come up with solutions now. It's not there on a play for you. You haven't got the technology.
You haven't got the numbers. You don't take things head on, right?
No, exactly. And it, you know, we've got, and the reason we,
I love the fact that the American Marines, we are the brave and the few. I'm going, mate, you're bigger than my country. You certainly ain't the few. Exactly. And you've got more things to play with than we've got to play with.
Yeah. I mean, we are such a small unit.
No disrespect to the US Marine Corps, by the way, here. I'm not looking to get filled in next time I turn out up in America.
No, they're great. They're a great unit. But
fantastic.
Yeah. We're just, you know, we've got a lot of history and we, you know, we're all about art and minds and coming up with thinking outside of the box. Mm. Every one of us is a thinking soldier, you know, not to say that soldiers are not, but we really have to come up with solutions to do sometimes what seems
because
impossible.
Because of just the numbers.
We're outnumbered. We haven't got the kit, you know, it's very dangerous most of the time. So you've got to
think
come up with an idea and a way of getting, and it won't be conventional, that's for sure.
Mm.
You just got to come up with something to make it happen, and we do. We've, you know, very fortunate. I've been on a lot of operations, and we've never failed. So unbelievable.
And is actually, and I say, I've met other special forces guys from other countries. There is only one that they refer to as the best, and it is the one that you served in for 23, 24 years, right?
Yep. Absolutely, yeah. And we are the best. I mean, I've worked with the Americans, I've worked with the Germans, I've worked with the French, I've worked with the Russians, you know, and we're in a different league, 100%.
Why?
Because our mentality, and again, the lack of kit, the lack of resources, and we just go out there and make it happen. We're a lot tougher in many ways. And we just, I don't know, we just always seem to get the results, and we do. We just work great as a team, we work great as individuals. And yeah, there's something different about us for sure.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
So there you are doing the fan dance. Yeah. 50% dropped out on the second day.
Yeah.
80 How does it whittle itself down after that?
Pretty sharpish over the. I mean, the first phase is we call it the hills over the Black Mountains, where you start off in small groups of four, then into twos. Then you're.
This was a winter. This was winter selection. There's two, isn't there? Summer and winter. Would you say one's better than the other?
They've all got the pros and cons. You know, the winter it's frigging freezing, of course, but it gets to move faster for me. You know, I want to keep warm, so I'll go quicker. The summer, you know, you can have the opposite effect in the summer. You know, it can be too hot. So
dehydrate.
Yeah, they're both hard. They're as hard as each other, but just for different reasons. But yeah.
Also, it doesn't help if you need to drown yourself, does it?
No. Jesus Christ, mate. That was an embarrassing moment as well.
It's not embarrassing, mate. You're just trying to avoid doing a click here and a click there to get across, which is thinking out of the box, which is what you're supposed to do, aren't you?
Absolutely, yeah.
It doesn't help, though, when the... You lose your rifle though, does it? In a river.
That's the amazing.
How cold was it?
Mate, it was frigging breathtaking. Absolutely freezing. And
I fell into a river once in Alaska, right? Doing a photo shoot for Hello Magazine. It's just like being going for selection.
harder. I did actually end up living on my own in the bivouac for about 11 days. But
that's a puzzle.
A low magazine came out, took a picture of me. And he's going, just move a little bit closer. Just move a little bit closer. Straight through the ice, mate.
Ooh.
And do you know what? Tom and Jerry moment. Because you literally do. It's that cold. Yeah. It goes up. You feel it coming up your body, don't you? It's like, ding, I'm an ice cube. Anyway, but I didn't have a rifle and I wasn't up for selection. So you are literally, you're not trying to get across it now. You're actually
trying into the water to get my rifle.
You're trolling to try and find your rifle.
Yeah, I was just, I literally just started off and the mist, you could not see your hand in front of your face. And obviously done the map study before, I ain't going to go right because there's another click. I'm going to go straight for the river.
Is it drifting? You're drifting away from where you drop your rifle. Your rifle isn't going to move like you're going to move, right?
I know. I'm there in the water with Bergen weighing about 80 pounds or something
now
ridiculous.
Now weighing considerably more because it's full of
water. Twice because it's now soaking wet as well, and I'm soaking wet. Yeah, I'm trying to find the weapon under the water.
How far were you through selection at this point?
This was on test week. So it was the last week of
phase one.
Yeah. This was the last week.
It could have all gone
I could have lost everything. Had I gone back to that vehicle with no weapon, that you're done, you're finished. Or had I have gone down, which I nearly did on that time, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Was that the closest you came to going down?
Yeah. It was one of those moments where...
You're hypothermic?
Yeah. And it felt like Mike Tyson had run along the side of me and just smacked me in the head. Mm. And I was very fortunate because I can remember it as clear as day. I was one of the fittest on selection. And basically, if you're a fit runner or, doing well, they'd set you off at the back because they want all the slow ones over the mountains first, So I was right at the very back. And I'd gone through this water.
Even though you've got to make the same checkpoints at the same time?
Yeah. You still, because you've been timed as an individual.
Individual, all right.
Yeah, so you've been.
But they just wanted to make sure that they all came in before it got dark, basically.
Yeah, exactly. So I was always at the back. And on this particular day, I was right at the back. I was the last one to go. And anyway, I ended up in that drama.
Did you have any indication? Sorry to interrupt, but did you have any indication at that point, at any point? Because you make the point in the book, and I've heard it before. For people that I've known who've made it into the regiment, was it's very different from the army. It's no shouting and screaming, go. It's entirely up to you whether you want to complete this
or not. And that's the hard thing. That's the hardest. It's that self-motivation. There's no encouragement and no discouragement. So you don't know. You never know. On the hills phase, you do know because you know your timings.
Right.
However, on some of the tabs, you're not allowed watches for whatever reason. But, so you've got a good indication you're doing all right.
Did you have any indication at that point where you were?
Where I was, I was doing. I knew I was doing okay. And again, because I was at the back. Mm. I was being set off the back, so they knew I was a strong
man. You're doing all right, that's what I'm saying. Then all of a sudden, it's gone, the plan's gone.
Tits up completely. Because it was about 28 Ks, I think, this particular day.
28 Ks.
Yeah. And I was just about...
A 200-pound pack and a rifle.
I'm now on top of a massive feature, and I'm looking down, and the guy who set off just before me, I'd overtaken him. He was, again, one of the faster runners. We'd overtaken everybody else. We'd already gone in front of everybody.
Did he pass?
Yeah, he did. So I'm coming down towards this checkpoint, and I've considered four turn on the road. I thought, well, that's a trick the map. Yeah, that's definitely a checkpoint. Yeah. So I don't know if that's the last one because you never tell you how far you're going. Then you just get given a next grid.
Man.
I know, this was the painful thing for me.
That's the thing about what makes you different, isn't it? It's because you never know where it's going to end.
You don't. You're not told how long the march is.
You've
got
to have
a
mindset that there is no end to this hell.
Keep going. Yeah. Go that bit further again. So I'm looking down and I could see the checkpoint. It's about 800 meters, 900 meters away off the mountain. And at the time, the guy who was behind me just comes up level with me and then carries on. And as I go to walk off, all of a sudden I felt like I'd just been smacked in the side of the head. I'm falling, stumbling all over the place. I'm starting to shake.
Hypothermic.
Yeah. Anyway, the guy in front of me, Andy, came back. He goes, "You all right?" I goes, "Andy, you better go."
It's hypothermia.
Yeah, hypothermia, basically. Long story short, I eventually staggered all the way down to the truck and I could see the DS watching me. And as I get to him, I'm thinking, I'm done. I can't go any further. I'm fucked. I'm absolutely out of it. And I get to him and he goes, "Are you okay?" And I went, "I don't think so." He went, "Get on the back of the four tonner."
That's it.
I thought, that's it, I'm done. What he didn't tell me. Yeah, it wasn't. That was the last checkpoint.
Thank.
I know, but I didn't.
What time did you realise?
When I got on the truck, Andy was on there. I thought, well, what happened to him? And then he goes, "No, this is definitely the last one." I was like, thank fuck for that. Yeah, because I was going down. Yeah, I was just going into a freaking coma virtually.
Had you failed selection at that point, had there been another checkpoint, would you have tried again?
I always say no, I wouldn't go again, but I don't know. if I'm honest.
I think it's in you to keep going, yeah. Personally.
I know.
So you get through that bit.
Yeah.
When do you find out you're actually in?
You then do that. Then once you've passed the hills, which was left.
Do you do interrogation?
Right at the very end. The next phase is the jungle. That's really selection. That's what selection is really about.
Is it?
Oh, yeah.
What makes that so different?
It's like doing
than doing what you did.
I'll tell you what. Please. It's like doing the hills phase again, the Black Mountains inside the jungle, inside a canopy in that Yuma with more weight.
And also, no disrespect, but and I'm no map reader, but you've got a fair idea of where you're going if you're in open hills, right? You suddenly get in a canopy where you can't see more than 10 meters and you've got to navigate yourself through that.
It's hard. You literally count every step.
Are you on your own again? Are you in groups of four or what?
No, you're doing patrols now. You're in a patrol of, you start with, depending on how many, I think there was about 26 of us got started in the jungle, or maybe 30, something like that. I can't remember the exact numbers. So they put you in patrols of six or eight.
All right.
And you have one DS assigned to you. And then as people fall,
staff.
One staff. And it's just physically and mentally full on all the time. You know, like you say, navigating, carrying the kit, patrolling, surviving, doing a task that they're teaching.
Just surviving in the jungle is hard enough. Mm-hmm. Water, keeping yourself clean, not getting bitten, I don't mean just by mosquitoes and by insects.
Leeches.
I mean snakes, leeches.
You're covered in leeches all the time. And it starts, you start off, I know, it's uncomfortable, and then in the end you're like, can't be bothered with it. They're everywhere. Hanging off your balls.
Have a drink on me.
Just let them fill up and pop. You get up in the morning, like you get your dry kit on. You get up in the morning, it looks like you've been shot with a shotgun.
There's a bleed dripping off you, man. Because they're filled up and then dropped off.
Yeah. Or you've rolled over and popped them, squashed it.
Oh, nice. A little bit of them still stuck inside you. Give you a nice infection.
Yeah. Oh, horrible. I mean, you get out, as soon as it gets dark.
But did you ever question, why am I doing this?
I enjoyed it. I don't know if it sounds weird. I loved it.
No. I get it. I don't know. I'd enjoy it as much as you. But I understand the achievement. The being out there... Being the best of the best, that's something that not many people will ever achieve. And the history of the regiment speaks for itself in terms of globally. You know, it's probably the SF brand, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's exactly that.
So you'd say the jungle was it. So how many people failed that?
I think, like I say, it's 27, let's say 30 of us went in. I think 10 of us, no, 9 of us came out.
No, again, yeah, they've gone through all that.
Yeah.
And you've still got another phase.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you've got, after you finish that, then you've got escape evasion, resistance to interrogation, where you go on the run.
Yeah. They dress you up in an old grey green coat and
World
no
War
boots.
II stuff and, which is horrible.
Was it?
Oh, it's horrible, yeah.
What's the worst bit?
And then again, it was freezing cold when we were doing it.
You've gone out to the jungle and then they fly you back to the Black Mountains.
And then you're back on the Black... Well, ours was actually over part of the Black Mountains, but it's up in Scotland or it could be in Wales or... Right. Yeah.
Somewhere that's not nice, basically.
Definitely not nice. Yeah. Soaking wet and these grey coats, they weigh a ton and rubbing against you all the time. And
you're being chased down, right?
Yeah, being chased with dogs, helicopters, Land Rovers, people.
And the people that are pursuing you are also people...
Military.
But they're not going to be in the regiment, are they?
They're not regiment, and they want to catch you.
They want you badly.
You're good hiding, yeah. it is. It's fun, to be honest. It's quite scary.
It's so fun. No, but mate,
it is. I mean, looking back,
what was the interrogation bit like?
I hated it. Absolutely hated it. I mean, the thing is, I knew it was a game. I knew they couldn't kill me. Reality, you probably are going to get killed. But I mean, so I knew, no matter what they did to me, I ain't going to talk. I'm not going to play that game. But towards the end, because we do 36 hours of interrogation. You know, what you see on the show is like 12 hours, I think they do.
Yeah.
We do 36 hours. It's a long old time. The stress positions absolutely kill you. You know, you're
just
in a...
Just like being held back, muscles going spasm.
If you just try and... You just stand up straight and put your arms out, leave them out and see how long you do that. It's horrible, isn't it? So you get 36 hours of that. The interrogation part is actually a relief. Because, in my head, I knew I'm not going to talk and it's just a game. I'm just going to play the game with them. But towards the end, I was so exhausted. I was hallucinating.
A bit sleep debt.
Yeah. I was hallucinating. And I remember it, just like you're sat there now, being dragged into the room, made to strip off to humiliate you. So it didn't bother me. I'm stood there like looking at him. And as I'm looking at you, all of a sudden, I'm like this. Shit. You were in a bath. just sat in a bar. In my head, I'm going, what's just happened to me? What's going on? I start going into a panic.
Deja vu time. Yeah. Getting out, get your brain starts playing tricks on you.
And just and he was a big bloke as well, big ginger bloke, and horrible. And he's looking at me and he's going, but talking to me really soft, what's your name? What's your number? What's your name? Jesus Christ. What did I just do? You know, I just went into a panic and thinking, my head starts spinning, thinking, have I said something? Have I spoke? I didn't know what I was doing. You know, so luckily, again, that was towards the end of it. It's the last couple of hours. So I managed to hang in there. But it was horrible. Absolutely horrible. I don't want to do it again.
I don't think you're going to be asked. No. Like, I don't think I could ever do anything close to it.
No.
So then you're in.
Yeah.
How do you find out?
Is it
really anticlimactic?
Yeah, it is.
After all that,
yeah.
Go on. What happens?
It is, but it isn't. You know, you're basically going to, you get back to Hereford, you do the last few sort of administrational things.
Do you know?
You've
got an inkling?
Yeah, you know by then. You know, by the end of combat survival, you're told, okay, you guys are, I mean, you're on probation. You're going to probation for a year. So you could still be binned, and people have. You know, you go to the regiment, because that's really just the start. You, what they're saying there is, you've passed a selection to see if you can do special forces stuff now. That's all it is. The special forces bit starts when you get to the squadron. So you're on a year's probation. You've still got to prove yourself. And if you mess up there, then you're gone. And people do get...
Oh, can you imagine?
Oh, yeah, I know. After you've done all that. And it's a different world.
You'd have to leave. You couldn't go back to your regiment, could you, after
that? No, it's the end of the
road. Sorry, I'm saying that. What do I know? But
many people do. I don't think I could. I think that would have been it for me. I'm done. But, or maybe I would have gone back. I don't know. But so this new world opens up and it is totally different.
I know you can't go into too much detail, but what are the major differences? There's no saluting, is there?
No, there's no rank. There is rank, but we don't use rank.
Yeah.
Everybody's first names. You know, you've got blokes with long hair, blokes with short hair, blokes with tashes, blokes with all sorts. It's just a mismatch. And you look around, and if I said to anybody, right, what's your image of an SAS guy? People go, 6'6", V-shed, nothing like that. There's a little bloke there with a pot belly, there's this, that, and we're just a total mismatch. And that's why they do so well, because it's not what you expect.
Particularly covert, right?
Yeah, yeah. And that little bloke with a pot belly will probably run you ragged for 48 hours non-stop.
Yeah,
unbelievable. So, yeah, it was just different, but what we were doing was different. It was real. This is all real. This is strategic level stuff now. We are going to do this in London. We're going to go and do this in Europe. We're somewhere, place in the world I've never heard of. You're like, geez. And you're expected from the word go to be part of that team. And I'll give you an example. Like a task will come in, say an hostage rescue in some faraway land. Come in and go, right, and it's ours, but it's going to go, right, guys, you're on the team. And we'll all just sat around the table like this. How are we going to do this then? Let's have a look at this. And Billy, look, as a new guy, Billy, what do you think? And you're like, you know, because everybody's got something to contribute. So it's like a Chinese parliament. We'll take all the bits and pieces, and then me as a sergeant major or whoever's in leading, I'll go, okay, guys, this is what we're going to do. And then start putting the plan together. And this is how it's going to happen. And it was just this new world. I was like, wow, this is different. And then you're off and you're doing it, real.
What about the toll on your family?
It's hard. You need a strong family to
Well, so many, I know, well, from people that I've met, that not many relationships survived. Not the first marriage that happened when you were originally started in the army.
Yeah. No, they don't. The relationships do take a battering. You live this different life as well, you know, because you're away all the time in operations. Half the time you can't say where you're going. You don't know how long you'd be gone for. I remember being told...
Is a chance that you may not be coming back, or if you do come back, you might be coming back missing bits.
Yeah, there is, mate. Yeah, I mean, that's real, and that's what it is. So it's tough. It's tough for the families, you know, and the people that deserve the pat on the back are them for putting up with us and putting up with what they've had to do.
It's interesting that it's in the book, and it's not the first time I've heard it from someone who served in the same regiment as you, is you get back and someone says... The dishwasher isn't working.
Oh, yeah.
The tiles need putting up in the shower. And even in my own little way, I've experienced that when I used to go away to Afghanistan. I used to go for a month, mate, which is nothing compared to what the guys are doing.
Yeah.
But you come back and you go, I just want to go into a bar and get absolutely pie-eyed and leave me alone. And then I'm ready. Give me 2 days to just decompress, and then I'm ready to put...
Yeah.
Do not, as soon as you come through the door, this, that, and this. And you think, well, actually, I've just been off...
Yeah.
Well, the only thing I really had to concentrate on was the job in hand, which is relatively simplistic for me. It was make sure I saw the sun come up the next morning. Mm. And then nothing compared to what you do.
right? But that is that's a conflict, isn't it?
Yeah,
because really, they're there on their own. And particularly in and one thing you mentioned, I think is really important that a lot of people don't understand is you're not getting paid that much.
No, you're not. It's not about the money.
What was your comparison in terms of as a sergeant major in the regiment and a sergeant major as a para? What's the difference?
Yeah, it's about over a month, it's about £1,500 difference, maybe £2,000.
That's easily spent, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's well spent. I mean, we're never...
Well, like everything, you always live according to your means, don't you?
And having a family as well, you know, I was never not overdrawn when I was in the regiment, but it wasn't about that. Didn't care, you know. Obviously, that's where the family has to struggle. They sort that out. I was being taken care of, getting me to where I need to be, then I'm going to go and do my job. And you become very selfish. And then when you come back, like you say, we never had time to decompress, and it was wrong. You're going straight into exactly that, the dishwasher or this, and I'd be like, do you know where I've just... Obviously, you didn't know where I've been.
Yeah, you don't know, and I can't probably tell you, right?
You know, there's people on the street, blah, 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 you know, and I'd just go into one. And the kids would be sat there going, oh, here we go again.
That angry man back again.
Yeah. And it was hard. It was difficult, you know, looking back.
Not saying you were, but I mean, that's...
There was the kids would be sat at the table waiting for dinner, and they'd be looking at me and her and thinking, are they going to be happy? Are they going to kick off? And it was sad. It was difficult. But we did, you know, you take it out on the families, and hence the reason, you know, a lot of them don't make it. It's just, again, it's been sorted out now. I think there's a lot more sort of welfare with the regiment, and you know, the blokes do get a chance to decompress. I believe we didn't. It was just full on. We literally come back. You could be at home. I remember one time I'd been away a particular place, and it was pretty dodgy and pretty full on. Came back. I was actually sat in the bath. My pager went off, and I was like, shit. And she looked at me and went, you better be kidding. I went, I've got to go. And I literally went into camp, and I got the classic, oh, it's all right. You know, you're going to go back home, come back in tomorrow, but you're going to be away for a couple of weeks. 5 months later, I came back.
5 months?
Yeah. Well, 5.5 months later, I came back. That was during the Bosnia campaign, because no one knew how it was going to go and what was going to go on, you know. But it was that classic 2 weeks. You and so-and-so were going to go out advanced for a couple of weeks, then you'll be back, and then we may all go back out, straight out then. That was it. So that was tough.
And the relationship didn't survive, right?
No, it didn't. No. And again, like I say, you become selfish. There was times I'd come back of an operation and I didn't have to go on the next one, or I didn't have to, but I wanted to. I didn't want to miss anything. We're all the same. We all wanted it. So you would actually volunteer for more stuff.
But did you not feel because of who you are?
Yeah.
Just no disrespect, quite exceptional human being. You were now getting promoted through the regiment.
Mm.
Did you know? And I'll be right, and I don't want to say the wrong thing, but officers often will come in for a period of time, a short period of time, and leave. It's the guys that are the NCOs, senior NCOs. They're the ones that are there all the time. Yeah. They're the ones that do the 25 years. Yeah. They're the ones that go through the doors, and they're the ones that do the killing.
Yeah.
Sorry.
That's what that, yeah. That's fact, exactly, that's how it is, yeah. And what you get is, you know, you get a new CO come in, and he obviously, he's only got 2 years. He wants as much as he can in those 2 years.
Well,
we're getting dragged along it.
He's got his own train set, hasn't he?
Yeah.
He's the new owner of the train set, and he's a big fat controller, and he wants exactly to do what to do.
And that's how I describe it. The regiment is a crazy train, travels at 1,000 miles an hour across the globe, doing unbelievable things. You get on it, you get off, sort out a problem, get back on it, and keep going. That's it. And you just keep going until eventually you walk out the gate.
That's 25 years of your life, sir.
Yeah. I know. I mean, and it goes like, I can, you know, from doing selection, I can see it as clear as day, but it's just all that in between. And then it's quite weird because I find myself, I'm talking to somebody and I feel, hang on, I've done that. I've seen that. And I've done all these things myself. That's why when I was writing the book, it was great for me. Going, I'm thinking, hell, yeah, I've done a lot. And there's a quarter of what I've done in there.
No, but you can't talk about most of it.
I know. But I mean, it's just crazy how much you fill in and how much you do in that period of 25 years.
How do you feel after, you know, you are one of the old school now, let's put it that way, right? Mm-hmm. How do you feel about some of the young school talking openly about being on the ground?
I mean, it should never happen. To be fair, I mean...
it doesn't happen that much.
No, it doesn't. And generally, if somebody's talking, well, from what I've seen, but if someone has been talking about something, it's out in the domain anyway. What the problem is, it's admitting to it, to saying the regiment's there. That's what the regiment doesn't like. And anybody who's talking, especially if you're talking about operational stuff, I mean, that's
You're giving up
that's,
stuff.
Yeah, that's bad. I mean, that's bad because you're putting people's lives at risk, you know, because a lot of the stuff we still use, the methods are still being used, or this operation's still ongoing. And with the way the world is today, you know, you've got to be very careful what you're saying and who you're saying it to, because, you know, look at the stuff that's happening with Northern Ireland right now. You know, people being dragged over the coals for all sorts of stuff. So it's a dangerous world. You've got to be very, very careful. And I don't talk about anything I was going to talk about anyway is in the domain. It's been, you know, it's well documented, but no. I don't talk about the regiment stuff on my talks and stuff. I just give an overview of what life was like we're talking now and this sort of thing.
Right. Yeah. But your view on people that do that is...
It's not good. No.
So let's move on, if we can, from just an unbelievably distinguished career as a Special Forces soldier. What happened next? Can I just point this out?
Yeah.
I'm the one that did 3 years of tap dancing, fencing, Stanislavski technique, Shakespeare, as your father. Oops, Mrs. Right? You're the one that ran around the world serving his country in the most extreme way you possibly can. Mm-hmm. You've been in more movies than I have.
I've only been in two.
But it's two more than I've been in. How'd that come about? Well, you did CP, didn't you? Close protection.
I did. Yeah. That's where I started. I started at the other side of the camera, looking after people.
Let's drop some big bombs.
Okay, so the first job was Tom Cruise. No, actually, it wasn't. Oh, it was when I was in the parachute. It was Hulk Hogan.
Hulk Hogan,
you ready? Mate, Hulk Hogan. It was hilarious. It was here at Wembley. He came over. They were doing this WrestleMania thing or whatever it was. And what a lovely bloke. But I remember him looking at me. He's huge. And I could see he's thinking, is this bloke hard as nails? Is he mental or what is it? And I just played it cool. And if I said sit down, he'd sit down. Yeah. But I remember on the night.
If you said to me, I'd do that as well. And I'm not Hulk Hogan. But go on. Sorry.
I remember on the night standing next to him to come into the arena, and there was two beautiful women in front of him. And they were, you know, big girls as well. Yeah. And he just picked them both up, one in each arm, sat them on his shoulders and just walked down. And I was like, looking at him thinking, and I was supposed to protect him. Yeah. So he was the first one.
Yeah.
And it was a bit of moonlighting work when I was in Power Edge, as we do. Yeah, because we needed the money. And that's where a lot of this, even when I was in the regiment, this is where it started for me again.
Yeah.
And it was Tom Cruise was the sort of biggest player at the time. And a mate of mine, he just says, look, he goes, I've been let down. He goes, any chance you can help me out? And I had a bit of time off. I had 4 or 5 days off. I said, yeah, I'll do it. No problem. So I flew out to Rome and met Tom Cruise. And again, he was brilliant. I met him at a private airport. And he was like, I knew him. He just had such a great rapport.
Yeah.
And what I loved about it was the respect.
Charismatic man, right?
Yeah.
Obviously. Well, he's the biggest movie star in the world, I guess.
Yeah. And I just, you know, I says, right, this is the situation. But everything I said about the security was right. Fantastic. Great. He goes, all I need is to be able to do this. If you can make it happen for me, it'd be great. And we had great respect and mutual support in each other on what needed to be done. And, you know, we had a few little incidents while I was out there with him, and it was great. Worked really well.
Other ones?
Then who was next? Russell Crowe.
How'd you get on with him?
I get on really well with Russell. You know, you've got to stop him fighting, not people trying to modify
him. I've had a dalliance with him.
Oh, yeah. I can imagine. I can see it. He's just one of them people.
The front page of The Sun was Grant 1, Gladiator 0. It was. Check it out.
Good one. But yeah, so...
Crowe took place a toilet in Zuma. There you go. But that's another day. I'll tell you about that afterwards.
You'll have to on a beer.
Yeah, so
I'll look
No, Russell's one of those people that needs protecting from himself, right? Yeah.
He's
well,
a great blogger.
He's not anymore, apparently.
No, he's calmed down now. But he's...
he's done all right for himself as well.
He has, yeah. I mean, frigging hell, I remember looking after him, right? The night Ricky Hatton won the world title up in Manchester.
They'll go up some time again.
Yeah, so I'd looked after Russell quite a bit, but he came over for the fight because he'd done Cinderella Man with Silver Screen, I think.
Yeah, boxing, better boxing, yeah.
And the guy Ricky won the title off, Vita Sue, was a world champion. He trained... Russell. Right. So what they were going to do was, before they launched Cinderella Man, they were going to get Russell to get into the ring at the end of the fight with Ricky Hatton, hold up the belt. Of course, he didn't win, did he? And I told him this was going to happen. And it was, I'll tell you what, mate, you got to picture this, right? So it's a Saturday night fight in Manchester. Man City have just played at home. Ricky Hatton's...
Just won the world champion.
Yeah, well,
and Russell's there to support the opposition.
Well, he walks out. So I go out to do the recce. I walk out to the arena and it's just... It's 28,000.
It's gone mad.
Yeah, drunken Man City. Yeah. I'm like, really hyper. And I'm like, so I walked out. I says, Russell,
Tell you what, you're braver men than me. I'd rather do selection, actually. Yeah. No, I'm joking, I wouldn't.
I'll tell you what, mate, I felt that way. I was like, right, listen, I said, get low profile. Keep your head down low. Do not piss these people
off. Keep low profile, yeah, that'll happen.
So what's he do? We walk out and he starts doing that gladiator thing. And the whole crowd's like, and I'm like, he goes, right, he shat his pants.
He should have gone, oh, you're not entertained. Yes, we are.
He's where we're sitting. I said, I don't know where you're sitting, mate, but I'm going that way. Yeah, so I looked after Russell. He was great, great fun. Good guy to work with, to be honest. And then I went to, who was next? I think it was Brad and Angie, I think. And that's when.
Brad Pitt.
Yeah,
Brad Pitt. I mentioned this twice now, but it's about time he won an Oscar. I was allowed to get one. Good on him.
I didn't realise.
He's a fantastic actor. I'm a big fan.
Yeah, they're both are, actually.
Yep.
But yeah, I was here at the time at the HAC. That was my leaving call.
Honourable Artillery Company. Yeah.
Yeah, so I was there. Again, I got a call.
So this is your departure.
This is my departure out of the military now. This is my leaving. I had a bit of a set to down the road there, and I was unhappy, and I took a bit of leave. And during that leave, I went out to Prague and met Angie and Brad, and she was filming a film called Wanted. Yeah.
Which is about an assassin, isn't it?
An assassin, yeah. A weird one with Morgan Freeman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It'd be more fun if Piers Morgan had been in it, I tell you what. He'd have been in the V. Joking. Good old Piersy. We love him.
Yeah.
We love you, Piers. So you spend time with all these these Hollywood A-listers, but you actually form a really strong relationship with Sean Penn.
Yeah, right? I did, yeah. I'd met Sean along this journey while I was with them, you know, various, as they do, they all cross over at some stage. Mm. And we hit it off. Sean never had security and, you know, he'd come and talk with me all the time. We'd have a beer. Brad was going to do a film called The Tree of Life I can't remember where we filmed it. I think it was California it started anyway. And Sean was also in the film. So he came over and we spent 3 months, but virtually just hanging out, you know, drinking, chatting, all that sort of stuff. So we formed this relationship. And then sometime later on, I end up in Haiti after the earthquake, 10 days after the earthquake.
2010?
Yeah, that's right. And long story short, I end up bumping into Sean again. He'd come out, he just formed his NGO, JPRHO, and they had a clinic up on the golf course, which Well, actually, the school up there, I built that.
Did you?
Yeah. I went over to Haiti to donate an hospital, believe it or not. Fly in an hospital, port a cabin type hospital, build it, walk away. That was the plan.
Did you do it off your own bat?
Off our own bat. I'd left. So in on this journey of being with celebrities, with business in Haiti, Iraq, mm-hmm. with a partner, which is mentioned in the book. And then one of the things we ended up doing while we were in Iraq, the earthquake happened. And I remember seeing it on the news, and although we're a security company, we had a very charitable arm as well. You know, we'd build schools, roads, wells, all that sort of stuff in Iraq. And I just said to my partner at the time, Frank, I says, look, we need to do something there.
Was Frank at Reg?
Yeah. Yeah, he was, yeah. Yeah. He was Peace Corps with me.
Right.
So I said, we should do something. He says, yeah, I think you're right. So long story short, we at the time, we were also building camps for the military around Iraq, these port cabin type things. I got in touch with somebody in Haiti. He says, what do you need? Told me. I said, right, let's donate and build an hospital. So we planned this. I was going to go out there into Port-au-Prince, make some liaison. And then
Haiti,
take it.
Let's just discuss Haiti. It's the first ever Black Republic, right?
That's right.
They revolted against the French. They turned the tricolour upside down.
Yep.
And it's the most benighted. I mean, that and the Democratic Republic of Congo are two of the most benighted places. Have had the most worst luck of any countries that I've ever been to.
Yeah.
They've either got a dictatorship that believes in voodoo that's doing awful things to people. They've been ripped off by everybody. And the Dominican Republic on the other side is a sort of paradise, isn't it?
It's flushing, yeah. It's crazy. It's unbelievable.
The line down the middle is like, you're cursed, you're not.
It's exactly that, mate. It's one of the weirdest scenarios I've been through, because I went to go into Haiti and I couldn't fly in because the runway was smashed. So I ended up in the Dominican Republic, yeah, and driving through. And it was beaches,
paradise,
normality. And as soon as you got to the checkpoint, and it's about 300 meters of no man's land, which is the checkpoint between the border. As soon as you cross that border, it was like you're on another planet.
Stepping out of heaven into hell. Right, yeah.
The road had gone, the houses down, bodies everywhere. It was stinking. You know, it was awful.
I remember this because we went not long after the earthquake, and then we went back like 3 months later to see, because all this money was promised by all these big, big, fantastic countries like the United States of America,
like the UK and like many, many other countries, right. and very little of that ever turned up. And, yeah. and people went in there, sewed people up and left them. So they got sepsis yeah. and stuff like that. You know, a lot of big promises made and very little on delivery. And it was when I became exactly. really aware that some really big organizations make very big promises to the media and deliver very little often yeah. on the ground. I mean, that's what I found there.
It's exactly that, mate.
And one of the things, and this is slightly sick, but I will say it. The reason that I'm in, and you're probably aware of this, but some of the people listening might be, well, the reason that a lot of the buildings flat packed under the earthquake was aggregate is supposed to be made, I don't know, out of sand, right? It's stones with yeah. sand. You mix it with concrete and it binds together. Mm-hmm. And what they've done on the cheap is they've taken the stones out of the river, so they were smooth pebbles. So when the building shook, they went like that.
It's like on marbles, yeah.
There were a pair of feet, right, sticking out from under one of these collapsed buildings. And the fattest people, well, the fattest things in Haiti in February, by February, were the dogs, because they were just eating
everything, yeah.
weren't they?
Yeah.
But it was a bit like something out of The Wizard of Oz. It was like there were these feet. They had a pair of trainers on one day, and by the week we got back there was nothing left. It was picked clean. But anyway, moving swiftly on. So yeah. you did that.
Yeah. So I did all the celebrity stuff, and then it was weird. I was back home, and I get a phone call from Sean. I was in the pub, actually, and he goes, like Sean does, he won't tell me what he wants, but he goes, I need you to come to Barcelona.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, why? And he wouldn't tell me. And at the time, I'd just been away somewhere. I'd been on a bodyguard job somewhere. I can't remember. I was with Brad and Angie. I'd just come back. And he said, I need you to come to Barcelona. And he wouldn't tell me why. And I said, I can't. I'm going over to see my missus, Jules. He says, American. And he knows Jules. And he says, oh, tell Jules.
Where did you meet Jules again?
I met her in Haiti.
So she was working for an NGO.
Yeah, she's a total trio girl. I love her to bits. She just wants to save the world, mate. She sets up her own NGO out there now. And we've been there 10 years.
So you out to Haiti still quite a lot?
Yeah, I was out there last month. I'm going back out. She's out there now.
I haven't been obviously back since the desert. Yeah. How are things?
Well,
they're never going to be good there, are they?
No, it's never going to. Unfortunately, I mean, there's progress, but it's slow progress. Real slow progress, but there is progress. But I mean, it's the corruption and, you know, it just never seems to end.
And also the fear that's created by the voodoo.
The voodoo stuff, yeah.
Controls.
Yeah, it's crazy.
There's a tower, isn't there, that overlooks, that apparently is built on skulls, and it overlooks the old government building described as a wedding cake smashed with a cricket bat. That's what it looked
like. That's exactly what it was like, yeah.
This big white dome.
Yeah, like somebody stepped on it. Yeah. But it's an improvement now.
So you get a phone call from Sean to go to Barcelona.
Yeah. Anyway, so I
hey, it's Sean. Yeah. Get over to Barcelona.
Yeah. And he goes, and I says, look, I ain't going to be able to do it because I'm going to see Jules. And he goes, look, there's a ticket for Jules as well. Come over. I went, okay. So I tell her about this. So as soon as I mentioned Sean's name, she's like, nope, whatever it's going to be. She's like, no. he wants me to go to Barcelona. No. And I goes, there's a ticket for you. She goes, I'm coming. She's always wanted to go. Long story short. So he said, when you get to the airport, tell me, I'll send you a document. And he did. And he sent me a script. So he sent me, I'm trying to read this script on my phone. I'm like, it's got my name in it. I goes, what's he playing at? It was hilarious. I'm now eighth actor, Reed, an assassin. And I'm like, I've never acted in my life. What am I going to do? Anyway, so I'm laughing about it. So we get to Barcelona. I was treated like an A-list. I got my own driver. There's a bunch of flowers for my missus. I'm like, I ain't used to this. This is going to be a Raki and Jeremy.
Wind-up.
Beautiful thing. Yeah, this is a wind-up. I get to the hotel, staying in a beautiful hotel. My room's massive, bigger than my house back in UK. I'm like, wow. And then I get a message come further down to my room saying, oh, Sean will be up in his room at whatever. He's got the penthouse on the top. You're all meeting up there. So we end up there and there's Ray Winston, all these actors, all these people. And they've all got the scripts. And he goes, we're going to go through a bit of the script. And so they're sitting around the table and, you know, Elder Sable will say a bit, he'll say a bit, somebody else will say a bit. And then they're all looking at me because it's my part. I'm like, what?
So you got Idris Elba, you got Ray Winston, you got Sean Penn, and you got Billy Billingham.
Exactly. So I'm like that. And he goes, and Sean's looking at me and I go, I'm reading it. It's Americanized. I went, mate, I wouldn't say that. And he goes, well, what would you say? I said, well, grab your weapons and get off to the fucking fence now. And he went, great, say that. I did. So in that movie, I just said what I wanted.
Did you enjoy it?
I did. I found it, it was hard work, if I'm honest. The bit where I get my arse out, that was filmed in Wimbledon. And 6 hours of getting my pants down, kicking my ass. No, because they're filming from that side, this side.
That side.
And you got to
that backside.
So check this out, right? Joel Silver, do you know who he is? He's a big Hollywood, you know, he's like close to Spielberg. He's one of them.
Right, that's why I don't know him, Billy. All right, fair enough. He's a very big producer, unlike you.
So he's obviously, he's on set and the filming, all they're looking in the editing thing, you know, in that, whatever you call it. And my missus is sat in there, Jules, and I'm there again, trousers down, another angle, here we go again. Anyway, we take a little break. Goes, all right, I've got to go to the toilet. I need to go for a poop. So I go past the tent. I says, Jules, watch this. And she says, what are you going to do? I said, watch the screen. What I'm going to do is I'm going to tissue up my ass. And when I drop my keg, it's going
to be
I'm going to stick this piece of paper in Sean's face. And she goes, don't do it. I said it as a joke. Anyway, so I'm on set now. We're doing going through it again. She's sat in the editing suite. I'm just about to get my trousers to about there. And I hear, this scream, stop, my missus. And Sean's like, what the fuck's going on? Stop filming. Everybody stops filming. She comes running over to the set, the van where I'm getting my pants down. She goes, I can't believe you. And I says, what's your problem? She's you've got the tissue up your ass. I went, no, I haven't. And what had happened is I got my, she saw the white label and started screaming. And Sean goes, that's 56 grand you've just cost us.
Because it is about it's minute ridiculous. Or 2 minutes.
Yeah. But yeah, it was good fun. I enjoyed it. And like I say, it was hard work. It was a lot of doing all that sort of stuff.
What about the sequel?
Well, funny old thing. Because in the movie, there's an obituary for me. They say I get killed. You don't see me get killed. And then towards the end of it, we were out in doing the red carpet thing in Vegas or somewhere. And Sean comes up to me and goes, I've got an idea. I goes, what? He goes, the sequel. I goes, really? And he said, listen, he goes, picture this. He goes, we're in Manhattan. It's St. Patrick's Day. Massive bands, massive crowds. I've just come out of a pub. I'm a little bit cut. And he goes, I look across through the crowd. The first face I see, Reed. You.
That's your character.
Yeah. I was like, okay. It never went anywhere. I think Sean and...
He's still waiting for the phone call.
Yeah. Yeah, but...
So yeah, acting not for you?
Nah. I did the Tree of Life as well. I played what was it? I was a gambler or something. And I just... Luckily, it got cut out because I didn't think the film was great.
But from a little Herbert in Walsall running around taking people's hats to Sergeant Major.
Of the SAS,
To movie star, to NGO worker, to running your own security business.
Yeah. And now we're on a TV show.
And now you're on a TV show. Yeah,
which is bizarre.
Do you find that bizarre?
Yeah,
it's good working with the lads.
Yeah, it is. It's good as being back in. You know, the banter's fun. It's great. You know, the lads are great. Foxy, Ollie, and Ant, they're good guys. And we kind of crossed paths in our military career anyway. So I knew of them. I didn't really know Ant. I'd known Ollie and Foxy, not really worked close with them, but I knew who they were. So it was, you know, when I got working with them again, it was great. It's good fun, and it's just like being in. You know what you don't see of you know what it's like. You just have such a crack. It's just. Brilliant.
Banter's good.
Yeah. And what I love about this is there's no script, not at all. We just say what we want. We do what we want to a degree. There's a pattern we've got to follow. There's certain challenges and it just rolls out.
Have you ever seen any of the people that have come through it that you thought could actually really, truly cut it?
No, not really. No, not full on. I mean, don't get me wrong. They're all great at what they do and they did well to get through that.
That's a mere Piccadillo in comparison.
Absolutely.
A mere slice.
So no. Yeah.
So not no.
Really. No. They're going to hate me now. All the people I could have done this. No, you couldn't.
So you're doing a UK tour?
Yeah, I am, yeah.
You sit there and you tell people as much as you can possibly tell them.
Yeah. I basically take them on this journey of meeting influential people, starting with the old guy at the boxing, Matt Gaunt, and so on. So it's kind of a deeper version of the book. And
but do you talk about, you know, the inspiration behind you going that bit further?
Yeah.
Do you think that you can convince other people to do that?
I do, yeah. And it's weird because I'm not one of these people.
So it's inspirational?
It is, yeah. Because people say, what's it about? And it's my journey. It's my trials and tribulations. And it ain't all, you know, reaching goals. I've gone for goals. But what happens?
As you say, it's occasional fights you've ended silver, right?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. You know, I have been, you know, and on things I've tried to do before, I've failed. But it's opened by going that little bit further and going forward, it opens up new avenues. And it's the reason I went from, you know, being security to celebrity type stuff. It's just other avenues. And it's always by pushing that little bit further. So that's what it's really about. But I tell the inspirational sort of bits in my life story. I'm not one of these who quotes, you know, take a bite of the earth and it becomes... I don't believe any of that shit, if I'm honest. And statistics, you know. And so I tell this journey and people in the audience go, like, for, you know, anybody who's read the book can relate to it. Like you did, you know, similar to your childhood. And people go, well, yeah, I can relate to that. Well, if he can do it, I can do it. And what amazes me...
I don't think mine was as colourful as yours in terms of what you got up to you, buddy. It was a little bit more extreme than mine, but of the same time. But if there's a message... If there's an abiding message of your years on the planet so far, which let's say you have taken 100%, well, actually a lot of people have sat in that chair, have taken life by the horns and shaken the life out of it. You've done it a lot more than most of them. I mean, you've lived life at 1,000 miles an hour, not 100 miles an hour.
Yeah.
What have you learned?
That believe in yourself. Don't give up. And you know, don't be, you know, listen to authority, gravitate to, I always gravitated towards elder people because I used to think they've been there and done it. Why reinvent the wheel? So I take the knowledge from elder people and then I decide how I'm going to use it, you know, and don't let somebody, just because he's in a more of an official position than you are, tell you that you can't do it. At least try or come up with a way. There's always an option. Find it and persevere with it. And even if you don't get to that goal, you'll certainly be in a better place anyway. So. Just don't give up. Yeah.
Thank you, sir.
Pleasure, thank you, mate. Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure, really. Really. Cheers, mate.
Pleasure, man.
Thanks.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Kempcast. If you haven't already, please subscribe, rate, and review. You can find me on Twitter at Ross Kemp and on Instagram at Ross Kemp TV. This has been a Freshwater and the Chancer Collective production. Thanks to the team and One Fine Play. And until the next episode, goodbye.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.